Well, with her death and the coming to the throne of England of Queen Elizabeth I, the terrible persecution under Mary Tudor ceased. Exiles who had fled the country during the persecution of Protestants by Mary started to return to England. It was in 1560 that the Geneva Bible was published, because some of our reformers who fled over to the continent gathered in Geneva and worked on the great Geneva Bible, which was the parent version of the Authorized Version and was carried by every soldier in Oliver Cromwell's parliamentary army. But many of them that had fled to the continent had observed the Presbyterian system of church government advocated by John Calvin, the great French reformer, and had been put into operation in Geneva. And so, having seen that, they returned to England with high hopes of a more thorough reform of the Church of England. However, Queen Elizabeth was convinced that the Church of England should not be more reformed. A group known as the Puritans arose within the Church of England, and these were people who wanted the church more thoroughly reformed. They wanted it purified, and that's how they got the name the Puritans. They desired three things: purity of life, purity of worship, purity of doctrine. And with this Puritan movement, they came to believe that the Church of England would never be thoroughly reformed in the direction that they wanted. They were persuaded that the Queen, Elizabeth I, would never allow this. So they started to meet outside of the official church in small meetings, and they became known as separatists, and many of them were severely persecuted. During the reign of Henry VIII, that was, of course, the father of Mary Tudor, Mary I, Bloody Mary, the Reformation in England commenced. And in certain parts of the country, the reforms that Henry put into operation were not welcomed. In Cornwall, for instance, and down in Cornwall they didn't speak English, they spoke Cornish at that time. That's right near the very tip of England. If you look at it like a great boot, it's right at the tip of the toe. And in Cornwall, there were found that the new prayer book that was introduced was in English, so it was of little benefit to the Cornish, and it was easy to work them up, and they were worked up by disaffected priests who wanted to return completely to Rome. Also in the north of England, there was rising. And these risings centered really on the dissolution of the monasteries. If you were here a couple of years ago when I spoke on the English Reformation, you'll remember how under Henry VIII, the monasteries were sacked, because they were places that had become bad places. They had been very good places. They were the hospitals and things like that. But by the time of Henry VIII, they were bad places. And under Henry VIII, they were dissolved, and he seized their treasures from the monasteries, the priories, and the abbeys. And they held a colossal proportion, I mean a colossal proportion, of the land of England and these holy houses. And these lands were given into the hands of large aristocratic estates, or the nouveau rich, the new rich. And these people required land to give them respectability, and they bought their way into the landed classes. And you see, often they stopped using the land that they acquired for arable purposes, because the monks had done that before. They'd used it as arable land, and of course they'd employed a lot of people to look after the crops. But now the new rich, they got this land and they put it down to grass and they grazed sheep. Therefore, they did not require the same amount of laborers, and many people found themselves out of work. Well, in the counties where the Pilgrim Fathers came from, that's the county of Lincolnshire and South Yorkshire and Nottinghamshire, there were insurrections. Now, earlier in the time of Henry VIII and the Reformation, the great archbishop, who was eventually burnt at the stake — I'd like to burn the present one at the stake, but that's another story — but the present archbishop, the then archbishop of Canterbury, Archbishop Cranmer, dealt very wisely with these people that were insurrectionists about the destruction of the monasteries and so on, and he sent his best ministers out to explain to them about the state of the monasteries and why they'd been sacked, And that prevented insurrections in many places. Thus, an area where at that time of the Reformation there had been insurrection suddenly became a great stronghold of Puritanism. Now, during the time of Elizabeth I, many separatist meetings were broken into. It was illegal to hold a service, a meeting, without the sanction of the local Church of England rector, the local Church of England minister. And many of the separatists suffered the indignity of their meetings being broken into, as you see depicted here. On the death of Elizabeth I, she dying without children, James VI of Scotland came to reign as James I of England. I know it's all a bit confusing, but that's what happened. James was told that, he was told about these separatists, and his reply was this: he would make them either conform or he would harry them out of the kingdom. Well, King James proved to be a great disappointment to very many people. The Puritans, thinking that James had grown up and had been educated within the Presbyterian Church of Scotland, thought that he would favor them when he came to the throne. Roman Catholics thought, as James had had a mother, Mary, Queen of Scots, who had very much imbibed Roman Catholicism, they would get a much easier life from him. However, when he arrived in England and became king in England, he showed his true colors, that he was a convinced Episcopalian or Anglican. Our map shows the areas where the Pilgrim Fathers came from, and one of the centers for the Pilgrim Fathers would eventually become a place called Scrooby Manor. At this place called Scrooby, holding the great manor house, were a family who had the responsibility of maintaining horses for the messengers that traveled up and down through England along what's called the Great Road. They also had to make sure that there was accommodation for any messengers who found themselves in need of accommodation as they took messages between England and Scotland. And the family that held the, quote, position of the post, as it was called, were a family by the name of Brewster. And the son of that family, a man called William Brewster, attended Cambridge University, which was a center of Puritanism. Indeed, he went to one of the most Puritan of the colleges in Cambridge, and he succeeded his father in the office of the post, as it was called. The gift of Scrooby Manor to the family and the position of post was in the hands of the Archbishop of York. Now, in England, the top archbishop is the Archbishop of Canterbury, and the next guy down is the Archbishop of York. When it became known that the Brewsters favored separatism, and indeed that a separatist meeting was even being held in Scrooby, Brewster was to lose his position. However, these events were still in the future. Puritans in this area of Lincolnshire would walk every Sunday to hear Richard Clifton preach in his church at Babworth. That's what you see up here on the screen at the moment, Babworth Parish Church. And the fact that people were coming to listen to this man preach from outside of the parish caused Richard Clifton to be hated by many of the so-called clergy round about him who were not Puritans. And they were forever looking for reasons to accuse him before the deanery court. Eventually, he was deprived of his living, and those that followed his teachings were having to look for a new spiritual home. A well-connected and famous family who lived in a place called Gainsborough went by the name of Hickman. There had been Christians among them for several generations since the time of the Reformation. And indeed, some well-known and famous people had stayed and been given hospitality by the Hickman family. During the great persecution under Mary Tudor, they had come under threat, but had escaped outright persecution, and in their home of Gainsborough Old Hall, they started to hold a separatist meeting. Today, Gainsborough Old Hall is preserved as a museum, and those who go to visit it see many of the things concerning the Hickman family and their Puritan stand. It was that now Richard Clifton and those that followed him started to travel from various places, many miles, to gather at the separatist meeting that was held here at Gainsborough Hall. John Smith had become the pastor of the meeting at Gainsborough. However, 12 miles that had to be travelled to Gainsborough week by week, and of course there were no motor vehicles or anything like that. So these 12 miles that had to be travelled to Gainsborough by those at Scrooby led to a meeting being opened up at Scrooby by this man, William Brewster, I mentioned. John Robinson joined, and Brewster and Richard Clifton, they took the oversight of this Christian fellowship. And so it was in the year 1606 that the Separatist Church at Scrooby was founded. That church continued until 1607, just a year, when it was decided that the persecution was such that it was impossible to worship God according to these people's consciences in England. Their meetings were held by night. The law of the land stated that anybody that had more than 8 people gathered together for religious worship were guilty of holding a so-called conventicle. And this number 8 that was allocated allowed for family members and servants gathering together. If 8 or more people were found gathered together for worship and prayer, the person holding the conventicle could be put into prison or deported. Anybody found at such a conventicle, especially if they were tradesmen, could have their tools of trade taken away from them. Indeed, even far worse punishments were given to some. Their noses were slit, their ears were cut off. So it was decided that those who had given up all hope of being able to worship God freely in England, according to conscience, would travel to Holland. The idea was that they would travel to Boston in England, take shipping, leave England, and join with a church that was known as a church that bore a strange title that was found in Amsterdam. It was known as the Church of the Ancient Britons. In those times, it was illegal to leave the country without the king's permission. So it was quite a dangerous task that they undertook. John Smith and his Gainsborough group were the first to leave. They reached Amsterdam in Holland, but by that time the Scrooby community decided to get things ready themselves back in England with a view to them also leaving. They sold up their goods and chattels, moved to the Lincolnshire town of Boston with a view to finding a captain who would take them across the sea. They made an agreement that they would meet up with a captain who took their money from them, put all their goods in his ship, said he would meet them about a mile or so from the town at a place on the river with them. In this creek, his ship could moor while they joined it. So they spent some time in Boston in the hope that in the night they would be able to leave England. Well, the ship indeed did leave Boston. This is modern Boston, you see here on the screen. However, when it rendezvoused with the pilgrims, the ship's captain had already given their position away. He had betrayed them to guards, and so the Lord's people were arrested. And the ship sailed away with all their goods and possessions in it, while they themselves were taken into custody. Not only had they lost all of their goods, and sold up all of their other possessions, and vacated their homes, they were now being held in custody. They were taken to the court that was held in the present Guildhall Museum in Boston. That's it there. A little earlier, I mentioned that this area was very Puritan. And so when the Pilgrim Fathers were brought before the court here, they found that they had many sympathizers in the court. And the punishment that was meted out to them was not as harsh as it might have been. While the leaders of the Pilgrim Fathers were imprisoned, the others were allowed to return to their places of residence, but of course they return to places that they had recently vacated. After some time, the Pilgrim Fathers that had been imprisoned were allowed to go back to their families. Then it was decided that a further attempt would be made to leave. This time it was decided the men would go further north, make arrangements with shipping, that the women, folk, and children would come down the River Trent. Therefore, at a place called Immingham, they would rendezvous with the ship, which had been engaged from the northern town of Hull. This ship was skippered by a Dutchman and was going to Holland, and it was thought he would be much less likely to betray them and give them away to the authorities than a British skipper. Well, they rendezvoused with the women folk, but as the tide turned, they found that they had run the ships aground, and therefore they couldn't get together with the men folk, and who were already on the big vessel that had come down from Hull. Long boats were lowered. The process of ferrying the women folk from the mouth of the River Trent over to the main vessel was commenced. However, as this was being undertaken, the ship's lookout saw guards coming along the shoreline, and the Dutch skipper, who had no desire to get into trouble with the English authorities, abandoned the operation of collecting the women, sailed out to sea despite the entreaties of the Pilgrim's Fathers. Despite the cries of the women folk and the anxiety of the men, the skipper would not change his mind, and so the Pilgrim Fathers could just leave their wives and children behind on the shoreline. Well, the guards arrested these women, but they proved to be a little bit of an embarrassment to the authorities. What could they do with them? And so it was that, to a large extent, a blind eye was turned to them, and one by one and two by two, they slipped out of the country of England to join up with their menfolk in Amsterdam. Now, near to the spot where the Pilgrim Fathers attempted to leave as a group stands this monument. As you can now see, it was put up in 1957, commemorating this attempt of September 1607. Well, so it was that by the year 1608, the Pilgrim Fathers had reached Amsterdam, Holland, but only to find that the Church of the Ancient Britons, as it was called, was a place where there were terrible quarrels going on. Is there anybody here with Dutch ancestry this morning? Oh, dear. Well, what I'm going to tell you, I'm not worried about upsetting you because you won't be able to see where I am and get at me. Well, somebody once said, if you got one Dutchman, you got a theologian. If you got two Dutchmen, you've got a church. And if you get three Dutchmen, you've got a schism. So this place, and I love the Dutch and I preach among them, especially in New Zealand, and I can vouch for the truth of that statement. And so there were these schisms and so on. And the people that were in this Church of the Ancient Britons felt themselves far superior spiritually to the new arrivals. And this despite the fact that there were open problems in the church, including open sin, which was not being dealt with. At last, some among the Pilgrim Fathers felt the best thing to do was to move from Amsterdam and start again. They therefore moved in Holland to the university town of Leiden, and here William Brewster established a printing press. They remained in Leiden for about 11 years, up until the year 1620. The university gave Brewster much of its work as he printed various books and papers that were needed by the students and scholars at the university. The measure of freedom and financial independence led him to start printing on his own, and he was printing tracts advocating separatism, and these started to be smuggled back into England. For many of the pilgrims in Leiden, there were difficulties. There was a guild system that governed those who could operate as craftsmen and tradesmen. It was very rigid, and even though some of the pilgrims were skilled in the professions and trades, the guilds would not allow them membership, And so the only work that they could get was that of laboring. Though their young people were being, as we would say today, homeschooled, they were taught in the homes, they found that they would still be liable for military service in the hands of the Dutch. A peace treaty between Holland and Spain was soon to expire, and the Pilgrims feared that if hostilities then broke out, their children could be called up to fight a war in which they really had no concern. They were also concerned that their young people were starting to imbibe the ways of Holland, and even despite their struggles, still felt themselves to be very English. However, matters came to a head when the tracts advocating separatism were traced back to Leiden. James I, King of England, was outraged, and he insisted that the supply and source of these tracts be struck down and be stopped. So William Brewster found himself under suspicion, and it was decided that perhaps the time had come to move yet again, and this time their eyes turned to America. Well, America had many potential colonizers by this time. The Virginia Company had set up an unsuccessful colony in what is the present-day Virginia. The French had tried to colonize the South. The Spaniards had arrived and had massacred the French colonists, and the attempts at the colonization of America had not really been successful up to this time. It came to the ears of the Pilgrim's fathers that the Ironmongers' Company in England wanted some colonists to come out to America. The idea was that manufactured goods could be traded with the Indians for animal skins and other things. These would then be shipped back to England and sold at a profit. But you see, the Ironmongers' Company needed some agents over in America to actually undertake the trading. The Pilgrim Fathers were very, very wary of returning to England in case they were imprisoned. The scene that we're looking at here on the screen is one of the great London prisons of that time, where many separatists were imprisoned. However, the king, when he was told about what was intended, asked what the colonists intended to live on. And when he was told they would do fishing, he said, well, that is an honorable profession. It was a profession of some of the apostles. Therefore, he allowed the scheme to go ahead. So the idea was that the Pilgrims would provide a ship in which they would travel over, while the Ironmongers would also provide a ship that would be packed with the manufacturer's goods that they were to trade, and so it was time to move yet again. Well, there were some amongst them who felt that they were themselves now too old to move yet again, Richard Clifton being one of them. However, there were others in England, separatists, that decided they would now join up with the Pilgrims, and that they would come over to what was then known as the New World. The negotiations that William Brewster and Robert Cushman had with the Ironmongers' Company had really been to the advantage of the Ironmongers, and the Pilgrims would find later that they would be forever in the Ironmongers' debt, no matter what they did. Brewster, while he was negotiating, found out that he could still be arrested for the tracts that he had printed and circulated. So he left the negotiations solely in the hands of Robert Cushman. The group from Leiden, with one or two who had remained in Amsterdam, made their way together to a place called Delfshaven, where they purchased a ship by the name of Speedwell. Never was a ship more incorrectly and badly named. This is the great Pilgrim Father Memorial. Holland is very proud of the part that it had in the life story of the Pilgrim Fathers, but this monument has been set up in Plymouth Rock State Park, reminding us of William Bradford, who was the first elected governor of the Plymouth Colony and was its historian. And so the Pilgrim Fathers left Holland to liaise with a ship that the Merchant Adventurers, or Ironmongers Company as they were called, provided a ship that was known as the Mayflower. The idea was that these boats would liaise in Southampton, and then, it being summer, would have the benefit of the better weather and the better tides to get safely over to the New World before the winter storms began. These two boats did in fact liaise and started out on their fateful journey. However, it soon became obvious that the Speedwell was in trouble. It had left Holland on the 22nd of July, 1620, liaised with the Mayflower, set off on its journey. There were 90 people on the Mayflower and 30 on the Speedwell. But the Speedwell found to be shipping water and sent out a signal by means of flags to the Mayflower that it would have to put in for repair. So they put into the Dartmouth in England, the port of Dartmouth, to have the boat repaired. And to pay for these repairs, some of the precious goods that they were bringing along with them had to be sold. They again departed from Dartmouth, but they had already lost some of the valuable summer days, and so it was on the 15th of August of that year that they set out. They got about 120 miles off the Land's End in England, when again the Speedwell was found to be shipping water. So there was no alternative for them but to return to the port, British port of Plymouth in Devon. Unfortunately, it had to be decided what to do, whether to carry on or whether to abandon their efforts. It was obvious that the Speedwell was in no condition to cross the Atlantic Ocean. 18 pilgrims decided they would not go on, including Robert Cushman and his family. But the remainder decided to continue, and so crammed into the already overburdened Mayflower, they continued on their journey. On the Barbican in Plymouth, there is this memorial. In Plymouth at this time, there were Puritans who were very sympathetic to the plight of the pilgrims, and they did much to try and alleviate the poverty, really, the poor conditions that the pilgrims were now in. The Mayflower was 90 feet in length, and as it was being loaded up, it was being decided who would continue and who would not carry on. And during that time, it met up with the Puritan Assembly of God's People in Plymouth for praise and worship. On the Barbican, as it's called in Plymouth, there is this memorial. There's a memorial to several important adventures that started out from here, not least the Mayflower sailings, as it did in 1620. Well, unfortunately, by now, the best of the summer weather had gone, and it was not until the 5th of September, 1620, that they were ready to sail. Before the Mayflower sailed, a sermon was preached. And in the course of his sermon, the preacher said this: God has shown us light. He hath more light yet to show us. And so it was that the pilgrims, with this watchword, started off on their journey. The Mayflower was hardly out of sight of land before many on board became violently seasick. One member of the crew cursed the colonists for being such poor sailors. The Mayflower sailed bravely over the Atlantic, which of course at this time was experiencing the autumn tides and autumn winds. The mast broke loose from its moorings, but unfortunately, William Brewster's printing press was on board, and the great screw that forced the plates together was taken and used to push the mast back into the moorings, and a repair was thus effected. However, because the mast was weak, often in a storm, the sails had to be lowered, and the Mayflower just had to ride out the storm for fear that the pressure on the sails could again damage the mast. Well, the pilgrims realized that some of the people on board, representing the ironmongers' company, were not of the same religious persuasion as themselves. And so the Mayflower Compact was drawn up, which all were invited to sign. It recognized the hand of God, the hand of providence in bringing them through to the situation that they were, and they all signed and committed themselves to a common cause. And although the expression was not used until many years later, basically it commits them to being one nation under God. And so it was on a vessel just 90 feet in length, 102 passengers, and 30 crew, endured 63 days at sea. The bread became saturated with seawater. The pilgrims were told to keep below deck because often the weather was so bad. And one man who became sort of claustrophobic, could stand being cooped in no longer, insisted on going out on the deck only to be swept into the sea. Fortunately, someone saw him being swept into the sea and threw a line to him and was able to pull him back on board. And during this passage, it was a miracle, really, that only one man had died. At last, landfall was made. However, it was far from the mouth of the Hudson River, where present-day New York stands, where the Pilgrims and the Ironmongers' Company had been aiming for. You see, the ship's captain had been bribed by the Dutch to deliberately avoid this area because the Dutch had the idea of colonizing it themselves. The journey had been so arduous, and the conditions of the pilgrims were now so weak, they decided that they would not go searching for the place that they thought they would end up, but rather seek to make landfall as soon as possible. They anchored in a cove which they christened Provincetown Harbor, and the pilgrims, weak and weary after their ordeals at sea, managed to sum up enough energy to go onto the deck of the Mayflower and return thanks to Almighty God, singing psalms of thanksgiving and offering prayers for their safety at being brought across the Atlantic Ocean. However, the land where they had arrived at consisted mainly of salt marsh and was not suitable to be farmed. So it was decided that some of their number would go exploring. Now, the map that we're looking at shows how the colonies were put together. As you can see, we find that they eventually ended up making the Plymouth Colony in the state of present-day Massachusetts. Some of the names of the places in that state we can relate back to the experience of the Pilgrim Fathers. So we see Plymouth and Boston and so on. A longboat was lowered, and some of the men went on an exploring mission. In the course of their exploring, they got taken in a terrible storm, and the mast of their longboat was broken. Mercifully, they managed to make landfall on an island and there spend a night before making their way back to the Mayflower. In their explorations, they did at last find a portion of land that could be farmed. The Mayflower was brought around from Cape Cod down into Provincetown Harbor, and the Mayflower pilgrims had now come across some land that had once been farmed by the Indians. Digging down, they found evidence of stubble and corn, and what they did not know was that this tribe of Indians that had farmed that area had an illness break out amongst them, and the tribe was being wiped out. The Pilgrim Fathers, though now in America, were far from being safe. Winter was come on. They had to quickly think about making shelter for themselves. John Carver was elected as governor, the first freely elected colonial governor in history. And the laws of the Virginia Company of London had no validity in New England. So the pilgrims now found themselves outside of the jurisdiction of existing laws. At first, the pilgrims worked communally, but it was thought that if every pilgrim family was told to make its own shelter, they would work at a faster pace, securing their accommodation for the coming winter. Unfortunately, in the months ahead, a terrible epidemic broke out. Many of them died, both young and old, were to die alike. John Carver, their governor, died in this way. And he was succeeded by William Bradford, who became the historian of the colonists. Now, these people, despite the harshness of their circumstances at that time, did not neglect worship. And Lord's Day by Lord's Day, they would go to worship. They had encountered Indians and had exchanged shots with the Indians. However, at that time, neither side had sustained any casualties. Well, imagine their surprise one day when an Indian walked boldly into the colony. Somerset, this Indian, walked into the colony. He had had contact with English-speaking peoples, merchants, fishermen, and could speak himself a certain amount of broken English. But he let the colonists, the pilgrims, know that there was another Indian that spoke much better English than himself. And so they were introduced to this other Indian, whose name was Squanto. He had been amongst about 20 Indians who had been captured by a certain Captain Hunt and sold in Spain as slaves. Fortunately, Squanto had managed to escape, made his way over to England, lived in London for some time before eventually returning to America. But he had made his way back to where he had come from, only to find that his tribe had been decimated with an epidemic. But these Indians were friendly, and they taught the pilgrims many things, including how to plant corn, how to manure the ground with fish, and how to trap animals. Unfortunately, there was another tribe of Indians that were hostile to that of Squanto. And when the pilgrims took up arms on behalf of the friendly tribe, of course they made an enemy of this other tribe. The pilgrims also cemented themselves into the friendship of Squanto's tribe by treating the Indian chief and his family, who were sick at that time. They tried to witness to the Indians, preaching to them, and one of the ways they would witness to them was they would never trade with them on the Lord's Day. The Lord's Day was observed, no matter how desperate the conditions that the pilgrims found themselves in, and it was thought that the first thing they needed to build was a fort that would accommodate the single people. The single young men were able to live in this fort. Well, in time, with the hostility of the Indians, it was found that the fort was not just to be a hostel, but a place of safety. Throughout the first winter that the pilgrims were there, they worked as best as they could, though they were debilitated by sickness from the epidemic that raged amongst them. And in the winter time, they were able to use the fort for worship. They were engaged in the preaching. They were encouraged by the preaching to continue on. And that word that had been given to them in Plymouth, God hath shown us light. God hath more light yet to show us, became a watchword and an encouragement unto them. When spring arrived, it was time for the Mayflower to return to England. The return of the Mayflower, of course, left the pilgrims without any possible means of returning themselves. And so it was on the 5th of April, 1621, that the Mayflower left on its return journey. Not one of the settlers wished to return with her, and the Plymouth colony proved to be a permanent settlement in New England. The Pilgrim Fathers' partners, the Ironmongers' Company, were very disappointed with the lack of revenue that the pilgrims were able to send them. And as the Mayflower started on its return journey, the pilgrims gathered to watch it sail away. They committed the sailors of the Mayflower into the hands of Almighty God and prayed that they would be given a safe passage home. And so it was that the Mayflower returned back to England. Being springtime, the pilgrims had to think about cultivating the grounds, and the Indians helped them greatly. Many of the seeds that they'd brought from England proved not suitable for cultivation in the USA, as we now know it. And so they began to cultivate what was known as Indian corn, or known to you, I think, as maize. When the Mayflower returned, that left the settlers with high hopes of other ships coming over. However, the ships that did come bore yet more colonists rather than the much-needed goods and supplies. And the people that came thought that they could just come and take from the provisions that the pilgrims had amassed. When the harvest was safely brought in, the pilgrims had their first thanksgiving. They returned thanks to Almighty God for the safe gathering of the harvest and for the abundance that they had. And of course, you still observe here in the U.S. the last Thursday in November, Thanksgiving, which was the anniversary of these families getting together for this meal. Well, the pilgrims decided to invite to their Thanksgiving feast the Red Indians who had proven to be their friends. 100 warriors arrived, all hungrily eyeing the preparations of their hospitable hosts, but it was soon realized there would not be enough food to go round. So some of the Indian braves went into the woods, and then they returned with wild turkeys and venison. And so turkey became one of the great traditional foods to be had at Thanksgiving. Well, they not only had this Thanksgiving meal, but they held a religious service, returning thanks to Almighty God for the blessings that they had received. Well, that's as much as I know about it, and the best I can tell you.